the fifth kind.
I've been a preacher for more than 30 years. I've studied and taught through the book of Genesis many, many times in churches all around the world. And I've trained pastors in the skills of interpreting text. You translate Elohim in the plural, it all makes sense that what we actually have is a conflict among the sky people, among the powerful ones, over how intelligent the human species is to be.
British Christianity was the thing to know and believe. And the local indigenous knowledge, well, that had to be irrelevant. The British didn't want alternative news, alternative truth, alternative history, didn't want any kind of story that would embolden independence movements or anything like that. They wanted full spectrum dominance, so the British provided the newspapers, the media, the school teachers, the police, the civil servants, so on and so forth. And the local knowledge had to be marginalized. Colonization in other parts of the world, this has been done very, very brutally. When the Roman Catholic Church discovered that there was a blip in the south of France in the medieval period, where they hadn't quite bedded down Catholic orthodoxy, they effected a genocide of around 1 million people. The population of Languedoc were all slaughtered by a succession of 19 popes to get rid of the alternative information. In Central and South America, the Portuguese and the Spanish slaughtered the priesthoods. They got rid of anyone who could read the ancient texts and burned the libraries. And it was a double measure. They wanted to burn everything that culture had curated in written form, and in case any texts survived, well, no one would know how to read them because they'd have killed the priests. Why is it happening? Why is it so important to stamp this information and this identity out? What is the relevance today? What is the power that the powers are so frightened of?
Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv. Before we get into it, our thanks to Surfshark VPN for sponsoring this video. VPNs, virtual private networks, are a really useful tool for protecting your privacy and securing your personal details online. Surfshark VPN is a service that protects your information by encrypting all the data that you send through the internet, keeping anyone unwanted from seeing it. Along with privacy and security, Surfshark VPN offers the ability to change your location with the click of a button, allowing access to sites, features, and streaming services otherwise restricted to certain locations. Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up, and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 3 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
I was in Brazil. I was in Amazonia. I was in Pernambuco. I spent 4 months in Brazil in the 1980s, and I had a wonderful time of it. I had a wonderful guide by the name of Augusto, who took me to some fascinating places to meet some amazing people. At one time, he took me to what he described as a harvest festival. Now, Brazil is a Roman Catholic country. Harvest festivals, I'd been to those before growing up in the UK, and I thought I know what was going on. And so we arrived at this town square in the evening, and it was a wonderful festival atmosphere and a party atmosphere. And I noticed that people were carrying these figurines made of corn, and this seemed to be part of the celebration. But Augusto had told me before we went to the event, he said, "Now, don't be fooled. People will tell you this is a Roman Catholic ceremony. But everything that happens outside of the church before we go in for the Mass has nothing to do with Roman Catholicism." And so I saw people with these corn figures and I asked, well, what are they? What are we celebrating? And they would say, well, we're thanking the Queen of Heaven for the harvest. Oh, all right, okay, I think I know what's going on. The Queen of Heaven, that's a title that the Roman Catholic Church has given to Mary, the mother of Jesus. So we're obviously thanking Jesus's mum for the harvest in some way. And this was just one of a number of ceremonies that happened, and then we went into the church for a mass. Well, after the event, Augusto debriefed with me, and he said, so what did you find out? And I said, well, I found out that we were thanking Jesus's mum for the harvest. Were we? He said. Who were we thanking? The Queen of Heaven. Ah, the Queen of Heaven, yes. And that's Jesus's mum, is it? He asked me, and I said, yeah, well, I think so. I think that's how, in the Catholic world, I think that's how this language works. And he said, well, you remember the lady we stayed with, Rita? Do you remember those figurines that she had in her front living room? Oh, yes, I said, and she did. She had two little porcelain figures on a little coffee table in her front room. Yes, I said, St. George and Mary. And he said, what makes you think they were St. George and Mary? And I said, well, St. George was wearing his uniform, you know, his white top with the red cross and everything. And Mary, well, that's the traditional depiction of Mary in blue and holding the baby. And he said, well, let me tell you, Rita's parents on her mother's side come from the interior. And so there is a lot of indigenous belief and ceremony and tradition that she's inherited from there. And on her father's side, there's a lot of family from West Africa because, of course, slaves were brought over for the plantations in Brazil from West Africa. And so there's African ceremony and tradition and religion that's been brought from there. It's quite possible that Rita uses those figurines for ceremonies to do with indigenous background and African background and nothing to do with Roman Catholicism. Oh, I said, and this was a bit of a stretch for me to think that these figurines might have been representative of something quite different and unknown to me. We're going to go to another harvest festival, he said, in a place called Pesquera, and you might want to ask some more probing questions. And so, sure enough, we went to this wonderful festival. Again, lovely party atmosphere, people genuinely happy and celebrating, and there were all kinds of foods and drinks, all derived from corn in some kind of way. And I had no idea you could make so much from corn, but indeed you can. Well, once again, there were figurines, we were celebrating the Queen of Heaven. But as I asked my questions in my halting Brasileiro, I realized there was another layer to this story. Who are we celebrating? The Queen of Heaven. And why is that? Because it was the Queen of Heaven who came down from the stars, came down from out of the heavens, and taught our ancestors how to cultivate corn and how to turn it into all kinds of foods. So this time around, I'm picking up on the fact that this was something that happened long before Jesus, long before Jesus's mum, that this visitation was way, way back in the ancestral past, and it was a primordial lesson in agronomy. This story of the Queen of Heaven began sounding a little bit more like the story of Hun Hunapu, the ancient Mayan story, the explanation of where they learned about plants that are good for food, good for medicine, good for consciousness. It sounded a bit more like the Zulu story of Mbab Mwana Warisa, this mysterious female entity who appears from somewhere and teaches the ancestors of the Zulu how to live on the land in harmony with the land and how to use the flora of the land for health and consciousness and well-being. It sounded like the story of the Nomos, the story told by the Dogon people of Mali, West Africa, as they explain the origins of their society and their technology. It sounds like the story of Oannes from ancient Babylon, this mysterious being who was clearly not human, who taught their ancestors, along with his friends, all the accoutrements of living as a human civilization on planet Earth. It sounded like the story of Shamhat, who civilized the ancient wild man in the ancient Sumerian story. Now, I didn't know any of those stories when I was 20-something in the 1980s. I learned those stories much, much later on and began to spot the parallels and the similarities. But what I did notice in Pesquera as I asked those questions in my Halting Brasileiro was that this was not the story of a supernatural eternal entity that we pray to for a good harvest or a healthy baby, that we were actually celebrating the memory of something that happened to the human race and the deep past, something to do with contact, something to do with cosmic help for human civilization on planet Earth. But when I was in Brazil in the 1980s, Pope John Paul II was trying to stamp out all the non-Catholic elements of these ceremonies and celebrations. He was busy cleaning up. And he wanted to get rid of all the African elements of these celebrations and get rid of all the indigenous elements of these celebrations and leave only the Portuguese Roman Catholic contribution that arrived in 1500 with Pedro Álvares Cabral. Everything else could be gotten rid of. Catholicism only was to remain. So he really was trying to clean up not only the practices, but the worldview of the people living in Brazil. And it was extraordinary to me to think that Portugal had been in Brazil for 500 years, and in all that time had failed to stamp out what was there before. The goal was to delete and replace, delete the indigenous knowledge with Catholic Orthodoxy and replace it with Catholic Orthodoxy, and they hadn't been able to do it, and the people were still resisting it. And I found that a very curious thing to behold. What was the power of this knowledge that it could survive against the odds for so long? Because what I was hearing as I asked my questions, you wouldn't hear it in church, you wouldn't hear it in school, you wouldn't hear it on the TV, you wouldn't hear it from the government. It was all unofficial folklore, and yet it had this power to persist. So we'll go somewhere else now. We'll go to the land of my fathers on my father's side. That's Ghana, West Africa, and we'll go there between 1874 and 1950, because that was the period during which the British ran Ghana. Now, when the British went into Ghana, they had a goal similar to Pedro Álvares Cabral in Brazil, and that was to run the country, to set the commodity prices, the exchange rates, set up the banking systems so that Britain could siphon off the wealth, so that the British crown could get the Ghanaian gold, and so that the British could benefit from sitting at the top of the economic tree and run the country. And so that's how it went until 1950, and my family has a proud involvement in the liberation of Ghana from British rule, to the extent that that has happened. And during that time, British Christianity was the thing to know and believe. And the local indigenous knowledge, well, that had to be irrelevant. The British didn't want alternative news, alternative truth, alternative history, didn't want any kind of story that would embolden independence movements or anything like that. They wanted full spectrum dominance. So the British provided the newspapers, the media, the school teachers, the police, the civil servants, so on and so forth. And the local knowledge had to be marginalized. Now, in colonization in other parts of the world, this has been done very, very brutally. So when the Roman Catholic Church discovered that there was a blip in the south of France in the medieval period, where they hadn't quite bedded down Catholic Orthodoxy, they effected a genocide of around 1 million people. The population of Languedoc were all slaughtered by a succession of 19 popes to get rid of the alternative information, empowering information that those people had. In Central and South America, the Portuguese and the Spanish slaughtered the priesthoods. They executed them, got rid of anyone who could read the ancient texts, and burned the libraries. And it was a double measure. They wanted to burn everything that culture had curated in written form, and in case any texts survived, well, no one would know how to read them because they'd have killed the priests. And so it was a very, very violent period. Well, Britain didn't do that in Ghana. Instead, it simply ran things like this, that if you wanted to get ahead as a young person in Ghana, then you would learn to speak British and dress British and act British. And to the extent you could do that, well, you would look like a good candidate for a good job and promotion, so on and so forth. And part of that cultural reprogramming meant you distanced yourself from your indigenous roots. And so if you had a mother or an aunt or a grandmother who hadn't quite bought into British Christianity and who still practiced the old ways and who still practiced healing and who still had experiences of interdimensional contact, well, you would be taught to look down on that person as a primitive, uneducated, a witch doctor, an idol worshipper. This was a grandmother to be ashamed of. And to an extent, Ghanaian culture bought into that. And it was through that kind of prejudice that Ghanaians were distanced from generations and generations of ancestral wisdom because they wanted to be successful in British Ghana. And so that's how things went until 1950. I share a little bit in my book, The Scars of Eden, as I began to peel back the layers of that story in the history of my own family and my wife's family. If we go briefly to Canada, the United States of America, and Australia, and if we go between 1880 and 1980, we will be in a period when the governments of those nations were doing their level best to get rid of indigenous memory and even to get rid of the continuity of the indigenous peoples as an ethnic force. So in Canada, over that period, 1880 to 1980, there was a stolen generation policy in which the state, in collaboration with the churches, would forcibly kidnap First Nation children and imprison them in what were called boarding schools, largely Catholic boarding schools, where they would be educated. What this really meant was that they were being taken from their First Nation families and stripped of their identity, abused, tortured, beaten, forbidden to speak their native language, forbidden to use their real names, and Christian orthodoxy would be programmed into them, and every memory of who they were and of their traditions and of the abilities that they were growing in their First Nation families, that would now be extinguished. I remember hearing the story of a man by the name of Ken Thomas. He was part of the stolen generation. He was taken by force by Catholic nuns when he was 6 years old, imprisoned in one of these youth detention centers, euphemistically known as boarding schools. And the first thing they did when they got him there was to hold him down and shave off all his hair. It was an absolutely traumatizing beginning to 10 years of full spectrum reprogramming. The reason that the hair was shaved off was not only to do with memory and identity, but because the Catholic nuns knew that First Nation Canadians used their hair to relate to the cosmos, to relate to the environment around them, that there are higher cognitive abilities that are related to long, healthy hair. And they wanted to cut off any latent abilities that Ken Thomas had at the age of 6 when they kidnapped him. I was speaking to a friend of mine who is a Navajo guardian, and he explained a little more about the significance of the shaving of the hair, and I'll come back to that a little later. Loss of language, of course, is another aspect of that. No speaking of their native language, and so they would forget their language and the stories that were carried in the rhythm and rhyme of that language. My Welsh grandfather had the same experience in the early 20th century as the British government tried to stamp out Welsh language to get rid of Welsh memory and Welsh story. In the USA, in that same period, 1880 to 1980, Native American initiation was illegalized. Can you imagine? The ceremonies were illegalized because the government did not want the transmission of information or higher cognitive abilities to be transmitted from one generation to the next. And they reckoned if they could stop it for 100 years, that would be enough to stop it altogether, to disempower the indigenous knowledge. In Canada, more than 10,000 of those kidnapped children were murdered by the nuns and priests who were tasked with their care. And so now the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that is operating in Canada is exposing what was clearly intended as a cultural genocide. Well, no less was intended by the policies in the United States of America, and no less was intended by the Stolen Generation policy in Australia. Again, same period between 1880 and 1980, Aboriginal children taken by force, imprisoned in youth detention centres, euphemistically known as missions. Again, it's a collaboration between state and church to stamp out the old knowledge, the old ways, cognitive powers, memory, and replace it with Christian orthodoxy. Now, although that policy was stopped in about 1977 in Australia, there is a sense in which it is still in place. And it's done a little bit more subtly, simply by locating schools well away from the traditional homelands of Aboriginal Australians. And so a few years ago, our then Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced the latest raft of Aboriginal communities that would be defunded. 150 Aboriginal homelands defunded, which meant that if the children were to be educated, and they have to be educated, then they would have to be sent away from their families, from their parents, from their grandparents, to be educated in English as a refugee in their own country in another part of the state. Well, of course, they're being educated in English. They are losing their Aboriginal language, and they are losing all the processes of initiation that would be happening if they were at home. So why is this happening? Why is Indigenous identity, knowledge, language, story being stamped out? As soon as you realize how concerted this is around the world, whether you're looking at Central America, South America, North America, United States of America, Canada, Australia, Ghana, it's the same story. Why is it happening? Why is it so important to stamp this information and this identity out? As soon as you see how concerted it is, that should be the signal to go and sit at the feet of the elders of these traditions, because by some miracle, those traditions have survived and their stories have survived. And there are guardians who can initiate new generations into the knowledge and the ways, the cognitive powers, and the ceremonies of their ancestors. And in Echoes of Eden, which is my new book, that's exactly what I've done. I sit at the feet of those elders and curators and guardians, and I listen for what is in the information for us. What is the relevance today? What is the power that the powers are so frightened of? And I find those traditions to be full of information that is empowering for the present day. Let's join some more dots. Let's go to Jerusalem in the 7th century BCE. At that time, clearly, there were festivals rather similar to the ones I experienced in Brazil, because we have discovered hundreds of handheld female figures, just like those corn figures I saw in Brazil, only these are made of terracotta. They're female figures, they're bare-breasted, and they've been decapitated, and they were thrown in a pit. Why was that? Because in the 7th century BCE, the cult of the Queen of Heaven, oh my goodness, there's that name again, was being stamped out by reforming Judean kings. And we find the inscriptions on these figurines, the figurines of Asherah, Anat, Kudzu, Hathor, Astarte, who was to become Aphrodite in the Roman tradition. Once again, female entities being commemorated who are at the root of our story as human beings with a knowledge of agronomy. This is where our knowledge of how to live on the planet came from. Which plants are good for food, which are good for medicines, which are good to avoid, which are good for higher consciousness, all credited to this female figure. And take a look at that. 7th century BCE, they were trying to stamp that out. 1980 in Brazil, still trying to stamp it out. So what are they trying to stamp out? The story that's being stamped out is the story of first contact. The story that says that Homo sapiens was nurtured by another intelligence. That human beings were assisted by another species from off-planet who came and helped our ancestors to establish themselves on the planet, to live in a non-animal way, a non-subsistence way, a way where we could farm and build towns and cities and a great civilization. All these ceremonies commemorate the primordial lesson in agronomy and medicine, whether you're going to Babylonia, Sumeria, the Zulu people, the Mayan people, the Dogon of West Africa, Cherokee, Iroquois, Aboriginal Australia. The stories are all there of our first contact and the fact that we are part of a cosmic family. And much of that information is often carried by the wise women of the people group. Not always, but a lot of that knowledge around plants has resided there. This is information about a populated universe. So if we had lived in a world where indigenous information was celebrated instead of suppressed, there would never have been a period where we didn't know what a close encounter was, or what a UFO was, or whether we're alone in the universe. We would know we're part of a populated universe, and we have family, and we have friends, and that we are related to those who have visited us in the deep past. We would know more about who we are as human beings. We would know more about our higher cognitive powers. And there's the connection. Why is it that the shamans and the wise women of societies through the ages are the ones with the higher cognitive powers, the ones who can do remote viewing and future viewing and self-healing? These things are all tied in together with the information that they curate. And the information is not just about the past. It's about implications for now, not just about our origins, but about what is possible for us today. Possible because of our higher cognitive abilities, possible because we can switch them back on, and possible because we are not alone. We have company, we have help, that it is possible to engage. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about engaging that help. If you were to go for healing to the wise women of Southern Africa, to the Nangas and Sangomas of Southern Africa, or if you were to go to the shaman of South America or Central America, or if you go to one of those idol worshippers in Ghana, or to Native American guardians in North America, or to the witchy woman in the hill country of the United States of America, or if you were to be brave and go and knock on the door of the cottage with the long-haired woman who lives in it on the edge of the forest and the fields in Great Britain, you would notice that there's something rather similar about their approach to helping you and getting you healed of whatever it is that you want healing from. Each of those figures, let's just call them a traditional healer, when you enter their room, would perceive you as entering with a cloud of company, a cloud of witnesses, as the New Testament calls it in Hebrews chapter 12. They would perceive you as being accompanied by spirits, to use the language of the New Testament in 1 John 4. And to get you healed, they would want to tune in to a conversation that's going on between your spirits and her spirits. And so the traditional healer knows there's this conversation going on and then will do things to alter her own state of consciousness so that she can tune into this conversation. Because the crowd of spirits around you is there to support you, is there to support your healing and your progress, there to give you guidance. And all the traditional healer has to do is tune in to what they are saying so that he or she will know what to do to help you. And that's their modality. Healing is a contact modality in those traditions. And so the whole idea of interdimensional contact, ancestral spirits, contact phenomena is an intrinsic part of healing in that worldview. Now, at first, that seems very, very different to what I was taught when I went into the world of ministry back in the 1980s. Except I now realize that many times I have experienced exactly what those traditional healers experienced. And I talk in Echoes of Eden about a lady called Bea. She came to our church for healing because she was really crippled up with terrible back pain, had terrible mobility issues. And she'd come to our church because we had a practice of praying for the sick in our church. And my pastor, Pastor Irwin, I call him in the book, from out of the blue, it seems, suddenly asked this lady, Bea, he said, Bea, tell me about your dad. And it became very clear very quickly that Bea absolutely hated her dad. And as she talked about her dad, her posture became even more scrunched up than it was before. And it was a story of trauma, trapped in her body, trapped emotion, to use that phrase. And Pastor Irwin said, Bea, do you think you're ready to let go of all the resentment that you rightly feel about your dad? Because though her dad hadn't abused her as such, he had such issues that it was easy to see how she'd come out of that family so hurt and wounded by what had happened. Are you willing to let go of all the resentment that you rightly hold towards your dad? Because that resentment isn't helping you, it's hurting you. Do you think you could let it go? Could you say, Father, forgive him, he knows not what he does? And she said, yes, yes, I can, and yes, I am ready. And so she did that in her own words. And as soon as she did, I could hear her breathing change. Her breathing slowed, went deeper. I could see her relaxing. After a few moments, she bent down to pick up her walking stick to go. And I said, Bea, we haven't prayed for your back yet. And suddenly she said, oh my goodness, I'm completely healed. And she was. She got up. And she walked carrying her crutches as she left the church and walked down the road. So I asked my boss, Pastor Irwin, what made you think to ask that question? Tell us about your dad. And he said, well, I don't know really. But when she walked in the room, I thought, oh, this poor lady, she seems so out of balance. How can we help her? And I just threw the question out there. And the thought came to my mind, ask her about her dad. The thought came to my mind, is what he said. Now, as a young Christian, I only had one way to interpret that. That was a word of knowledge. That was the Spirit of God dispensing a piece of information to a Christian worker so that the Christian worker can help the person who's come for ministry. If I told that story to a Sangoma or a Nanga, they would say, ah, the ancestors helped you. Now, to be honest, I can't really know exactly where that thought came from. Is the Nanga right, that it was an ancestral spirit speaking that word into Irwin's mind? Was I right that it was the Holy Spirit of God giving that information? I have no way of knowing. And I don't put those two possibilities out there as dichotomies, because Irwin asked God, but the help can come from anywhere. If God is the source of the cosmos and everything in it, that in which we all live and move and have our being, that's the Apostle Paul's definition of God, then we can put our question to the universe, to God, and the help can come from anywhere. And a Nanga or a Sangoma would say that was an ancestor who provided the help. Not to take credit from God, that's just how it came. That's just the instrumentality of that moment. And I've since learned, of course, that the word of knowledge, to use that phrase, is used by traditional healers all around the world and used by people who may have no religious belief or spiritual background. It's something we all experience. I do a lot of personal coaching, and very often I will say to my coachees, do you know, I'm beginning to believe that what it says in Hebrews 12 in the New Testament is right, that we all have a cloud of invisible witnesses, a cloud of ancestral helpers surrounding us, very interested in us and in how we're running the race marked out for us. I'm beginning to believe we all have a cloud of spiritual help, and that from time to time they give us a little nudge or give us a little word. Do you know, I've yet to find any coaching client who doesn't agree with that and who doesn't say, I'm coming to believe that myself as well. And not because it's part of their belief system. No, it's part of their experience as they go through life. That they're getting these little nudges. They're getting these synchronicities. They're getting these phrases coming into their minds. And I now know that it was there in primitive Christianity, just the same as in all these other indigenous traditions, that we have this cloud of help around us, wishing to assist us on our journey, if we will only tune in and take notice. And what I find wonderful about that rediscovery, to find it in the New Testament and then discover it in indigenous narratives, is what an affirming view that is. That you have an invisible team around you right now to support your learning, to support your journey, to see that you have the best human experience you can have while in this material realm and as you go through life. The great secret is that help is at hand. And I think that really speaks to the confidence with which we go through life. I remember back in the 90s, I think it was, Mother Teresa visited Great Britain. And she had worked for a long time among the untouchables of Calcutta. Now, the untouchables are people that the whole of Indian society says, these people are disgusting, they're not to be acknowledged, you don't touch them, you don't look at them, you don't talk to them. And there's another class of people below the untouchables, they only come out at night, that you never even acknowledge exist, because they're the very bottom of society. You would think those people would have a self-esteem problem, wouldn't you, when they've got a seventh of the world's population telling them that they're rubbish. But Mother Teresa, having worked with those people, visited Great Britain in the early 1990s, and she said she had never encountered such a horrible loss of self-esteem as what she experienced among the teenagers of Great Britain. Now, what does that tell you? How can the self-esteem of teenagers in Great Britain be worse than the self-esteem of the untouchables in Calcutta? It has to do with the world in which we live and the world view with which we journey. If you live in a world where you are on your own, then you are on your own. But our ancestors tell us none of us are on our own. Whatever the visible world is doing to you, you have an invisible team of supporters. You have great-grandparents, great-great-great-great-grandparents. You have spirits from other dimensions who are very interested in you and helping you through whatever is happening in your life. It's an incredibly empowering worldview, and it's the one our ancestors have journeyed with for thousands of years. Now, what's interesting about that worldview is that when you talk to traditional healers, sometimes they're a little bit agnostic about who are the helpers and how they help and how they communicate transdimensionally and how they're around if they're from generations past, or exactly what they are if they're spirits, in the words of the writer of 1 John. It doesn't matter, apparently, who, what, and how. What's more important when you talk to the traditional healers is that we listen and then weigh up, that you and I keep our sovereignty, that you and I keep our autonomy and weigh up what we hear. Because if we're willing to do that and say, well, that makes sense, that doesn't make sense, I'm not going to do that, but I will follow that. As long as we do that, it doesn't matter who those voices are, because you've kept your sovereignty. And what I find very interesting is that Imperial Christianity didn't want any of that. First of all, it didn't want agnosticism. It wanted people who believed in dogma. First of all, again, it didn't want people with personal sovereignty. It wanted people who were passive and obedient and who distrusted themselves and trusted authorities more than they trusted themselves. So on both those counts, they don't want this traditional worldview. And they certainly didn't want other sources of truth and information and healing. They wanted a monopoly of truth, as does any imperial power. The idea that there would be other entities running around giving you alternative information or alternative sources of power or healing. No empire wants that. What it wants is people who are dependent on the state powers. They don't want grassroots empowerment. And this indigenous story is about grassroots empowerment by our ancestors, by the spirits. When I was in Brazil in the 1980s, there were two big forces at play. I was there studying Christian spirituality and what was happening in terms of church life and church planting. There were the top-down powers, John Paul II and the diocese, who were trying to shut down indigenous knowledge. And then there were grassroots catalysts. They were also Roman Catholics, but they were monastic workers who were empowering local populations. And it was from that second group that I found Augusto, who gave me my education as to what was really going on. But whether you're looking at Brazil in the 1980s, or the Roman Empire as it hijacked Christianity, or whether you're looking at ancient Judaism in the 7th century BCE, or Ghana, Canada, USA, Australia, the picture is the same. What the powers want is God and the king at the top, or God and the president at the top. And then in the middle, you have the priests, the public servants, the education system, the media. And then at the bottom, you've got the people, who believe what they're told and do what they're told. That's the pyramid of powers that empire always likes to run with. They want people who are always looking for permission to do things, who are dependent on the state for the truth and information and health. The indigenous stories present a different world, one in which we are surrounded by company and help and information and health and confidence. The indigenous stories say we have help with agronomy, that you can have transdimensional help, teaching you what plants are good for food and medicine and higher consciousness, that people can have help with civil engineering, can know things about sacred architecture that elevate our cognitive powers, that aid us in interdimensional contact with our neighbors. Indigenous story tells us there's help with information, that it's not just the state education system providing us information, that in fact, we can heighten our cognitive abilities through contact. Many experiences of close encounters experienced heightened cognitive abilities in the aftermath. And when I read Plato, I read someone who acknowledges a whole chunk of his information has come from interdimensional contact and altered states of consciousness. And maybe that's why the authorities are so against all the things that enable us to engage with altered states of consciousness. There is help with self-esteem the moment you begin listening to the support team that exists around you. We are cut off from this indigenous wisdom largely through prejudice. It's not at present, where most of us are living, through aggressive, violent colonization and execution, although we've had a bit of that. I mean, if you think about what happened to whistleblowers around ET contact in the 1980s, we've had a bit of that quite recently. But it's really a cultural education that says there is education and then there's ignorance. And there is sophistication, and then there's the ignorant local information that we call folklore and story and myth. And we confuse the stories of the wise women of our cultural heritage with the stories of the wild women who are insane and we don't go anywhere near them. I mean, if I talk about growing up in Britain, I just knew instinctively that it was not a good idea to go anywhere near that woman who never cuts her hair and who lives in that very humble cottage on the edge of the forest in the fields, and who knows how to do things with the local flora, and who curates the local histories and mythologies. You just knew to stay away from her, and maybe she's insane as well. And that's the kind of prejudice that we are given around the wise women or the witchy women of Northern Europe, of North America. Not much has to be said. So many cultural references out there to tell us to stay away. And yet those are the people who've curated the old ways. You know, we can get quite romantic when I say, oh, go to the curators of Native American tradition, or sit at the feet of a Navajo guardian, or find the elders of an Aboriginal Australian tribe. Oh, yes, I'd love to do that. I'll make that part of my holiday. But in fact, all cultures have this, and the English have it as well. Only we have a prejudice against our own. And so what I discovered as I researched Echoes of Eden is that if you really want to start tapping the ancestral wisdom of the human race, the grassroots knowledge of contact, the grassroots knowledge of higher cognitive powers and how to tap them, you have to decide in advance to overcome all that cultural programming. Just as in Ghana, there was a certain way to behave if you wanted people to think you were educated and intelligent. That's true of all of us. We all have that. We all want people to think we're intelligent and clever. And we have to be willing at some point to say, blow that. I want to know what's going on. I'm going to visit that lady and I'm going to ask her to tell me some stories. I always notice the wise women who never cut their hair in the places where I live today and find ways of having conversations with them. And so part of what I want to share today is to encourage you to do that for yourself, to go back to traditions that you've dismissed, to go back to traditions that you said, well, those are heretics, or they were crazy, or they were insane, or they were probably demonized, or what, however it is that our thinking has been poisoned, and say, no, I want to listen again. I'm going to keep my sovereignty. I'm going to weigh it up. Don't have to believe everything I'm told, but I want to know what it is I've missed. That's the journey I share in Echoes of Eden, and I've discovered that when we go to the indigenous sources, we hear stories about human origins, and we learn that we, you and me, are ET hybrid beings, and we start probing what that means for us today. We learn things about human health and healing, and we re-empower ourselves so that we're not always dependent on departments of health to look after us for us. We discover cosmic information about the universe we live in, about the planet we live in. I've found myself, to my surprise, writing about portals, not only in space, not only in ancient Iraq, but down the road from me in New South Wales, because that's part of the indigenous knowledge. I'm learning about natural foods for health. I'm learning about altered states of consciousness and how to access them, and then how to use the information that comes through them. I'm learning about contact with my ancestors and other beings, and I'm learning to operate higher cognitive skills like remote viewing, future viewing, telepathic connection, self-healing. But to do that, and all those things are absolutely intertwined in our indigenous narratives, we have to overcome our cultural programming. We have to no longer fear superstition, folklore, all these words, witchcraft, idolatry. These words have simply been put there as gates to prevent us going any further to finding out what's behind those doors. But if we're willing to bust through those taboo words and be laughed at, ridiculed, or feared because we're doing it, and if we're willing to listen without prejudice to these ancient sources, then we have so much to discover. We are so programmed to demonize the other, whether it's another culture or even the roots of our own culture. And a fun way to start is to stop and think about who you are. Where have you come from? What's your ancestry? Because whatever your ancestry is, and it's amazing when I ask Australians, modern Australians, where are you from? They'll say, oh, nowhere, I'm Australian. Oh, you're Australian, so you're from nowhere. And they forget that most Australians have arrived here since the Second World War from somewhere else. And then, of course, we have the Aboriginal presence in Australia that goes back more than 60,000 years. And that, too, came from somewhere else. So there's always an answer to the question, where do you come from? And wherever it is, there will be traditional stories that belong to your culture. And so right now, I'm beginning to think about harvest festivals we did at school when I was a little boy, where we held little corn dollies. What were they? And who were they commemorating? Because you can bet your bottom dollar it's not what the Church of England told me it meant back in the 1960s when I was at school. And so it's that rediscovery that my book Echoes of Eden is all about. You can pre-order the Kindle edition right now, and the paperback is available on the 1st of May. I would love you to share this part of the journey with me, and I will look forward to getting into conversation with you about these amazing truths from our heritage that can inform how we live on the planet today.
Author and researcher Paul Wallace probes the world's ancient mythologies for clues about the origins of the human race and has published several books in the field of mysticism and spirituality. In the last decade, his work has probed the world's ancient mythologies for the insights they hold on our origins as a species and our potential as human beings. Paul's work in church ministry has included training pastors in the interpretation of biblical texts, working as a troubleshooter for communities of faith, and serving as an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia.
Endorsed by George Norrie and Eric von Daniken, Paul Wallace's latest book, Echoes of Eden, explores what secrets of human potential were buried with our ancestors' memories of ET contact. From Senate briefings in Washington, D.C., to secret ceremonies in Southern Africa, from strange phenomena in Australia and Iraq, to mysterious encounters in modern Brazil and ancient Greece. Echoes of Eden will take you around the globe to discover why military, intelligence, and other government agencies are so interested in archaeology, indigenous rituals, and traditional initiation practices. What is the connection between higher cognitive powers like remote viewing and precognition and ET contact in the deep past? And what are the implications for us today? Echoes of Eden, out now. Available on Amazon. Follow the links in the description.
Go to www.paulanthonywallace.com for information about Paul and his books.
I'm going to take you back to something that happened to me when I was very young in the 1980s in Brazil, when I spent some time in Amazonia, and some experiences that I had there taught me early on always to be willing to look again in case I'd missed something, always to go back and listen again for the hidden layers of the story that I might have missed the first time around. And so that's really the theme of what I'm going to share today. Look again and listen again for the hidden layers.